I'm Christopher Leiden with the scholar Catherine Lutz, who has made a lot of news this summer with a firm, fairly conservative, $3.5 trillion price tag on our 10 years of war since 9/11. We're reckoning with the costs of war, and of course, the dollars are just the start of it. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, where Catherine Lutz chairs the anthropology department and helped spark a thorough cost accounting for the wars that began in Afghanistan and then Iraq and wherever in and out of Pakistan. Catherine Lutz, congratulations on this rather chilling study. Give us the big numbers and then we'll try to see them in context.
Okay, well, the big numbers are the body count. We have to start with the humans who have really suffered death and injury from the wars over the last 10 years. And most Americans know the 6,000 number. They know the American service members who've died. That's a tragic number, but it's a very small portion of the whole. The 260,000, really, if you very conservatively estimate how many people have died directly from the violence. But the actual number is multiples of that 250,000 people who've died, civilian and uniformed, because you have to also include the people who die indirectly. They die from lack of medical care. They die from loss of their food supply. And those numbers are really quite staggering.
Reckon the expenditures in dollars, Kathy.
President Obama uses a $1 trillion figure to talk about the cost of the wars over the last 10 years. But in fact, what he's only counting are war allocations specifically for those wars. Our team of economists looked at the bigger picture of all of the places that money has been flowing in order to pay for the wars. And that includes additions to the Pentagon base budget, includes massive new funding for the Department of Homeland Security, for State Department, which it's used in these three war zones. And we then come to a figure closer to $2.5 trillion just for all of that federal spending. But in addition, what we need to also look at is costs we're obligated to pay in the future. And those include caring for veterans most substantially. And they're up to $1 trillion will be spent over the next several decades in order to take care of those who've been injured or fallen ill in the war zones. Then that gets us to almost $4 trillion for current and future obligated costs. In addition, we pay for these wars by borrowing. And so there's an additional up to $1 trillion of interest payments that we'll have to make just in the next decade. That gets us to $5 trillion. So the true figure is really, again, multiples of what the government is telling us these wars have cost.
The multiples in direct comparison to the expenses of 9/11 itself fascinate me. 3,000 people died. You say 250,000, maybe many, many more died in the remedy, so to speak. That's a multiple of 80, 90, 100 to 1 in terms of human lives. But the numbers, the multiples and expenses are fantastic. You and others have estimated that Osama bin Laden may have invested $500,000 in training his team for 9/11, we will have spent something like $7, $8, $9 million for every dollar he spent. So if you were thinking, if he somewhere in hell is contemplating the payoff, it's 10 million to one.
Phenomenal.
Could he have planned it that way?
One could talk about overreaction to 9/11, but I think we have to also talk about what the Iraq war was all about. We know that it had nothing to do with 9/11, that 9/11 was the pretext for that invasion. And so all of that, the lost lives and the dollars for Iraq were not even really intended as remedy, right? And in fact, we have to sort of ask ourselves, how did that happen? And how does it continue to happen that the United States has so many troops and continues to lose people in Iraq, and where civilians are also, again, continue to be dislocated from their homes and dying in attacks and so on.
It could be argued that there are lots of other costs still out there that you haven't even mentioned. For example, what is the link between these 10 years of war and an American and a world economy that seems to be spinning toward grave trouble.
Well, at least one of the effects of these wars has been to basically divert resources from building those basics of a modern economy, a strong education system, a strong infrastructure of transit, and so on, and to divert those resources into making war and occupying Iraq and Afghanistan. So we invested in something other than the basics of a strong economy. The assumption that many people will make that war is good for the economy is based on a kind of older model of what World War II did for the American economy. Mm-hmm. In fact, the costs to the American economy on the employment front have been substantial. The economist Garrett Peltier estimates in our report that 800,000 jobs would have been created had that same money been spent on health care or investing in education. Similarly, hundreds of thousands of additional jobs above those created by military spending would have been created. These are the sectors that have suffered by a drying up of funds, by a lack of a political will to invest there and instead invest in the wars.
Could I ask about a category of cost that isn't in your report? If it were part of the American cost of these wars to fix the damage we did, to rebuild Iraq for Iraqi people who did us no damage, what would that add to the figure?
That's a number that we have not yet calculated, and I think it's a very important question. You know, what would need to be done to really return those two, three countries, really, to the state they were in before? And actually, William Blum just made a very telling analogy. He said, you know, people will often say, well, whatever happened in Iraq, you know, at least we got rid of Saddam Hussein for you. And he said, well, you know, that's sort of like you go to the doctor, you've got a knee problem, and he takes off your whole leg. Are we supposed to then say, well, thank God I don't have that knee problem anymore? Or do we say, you're responsible for ruining my life, right?
Catherine Lutz, I know you assembled this report with lots of help, including Nita Crawfords at Boston University, Linda Bilmes at Harvard, Anita Dench, The Economist, and what, a score of other scholars and contributors. How did it fall to you? And what was it like to take on that mission?
Well, we're at universities, most of us, and that's our job to create knowledge, to go out and ask research questions and get the answers as best we can. And I think, but your question really goes to the heart of one of the big problems we were trying to address, which is, why don't we know this now? Why haven't we known this year after year of the last 10? Why has the U.S. government not sort of said, you know, we need to collect this data. We need to know how many people have died. We need to know how many U.S. service members have committed suicide and how many have been, you know, injured and what kind of long-term disabilities are how many people living with, and to put that out to the public and to allow policymakers to have that information when they work on developing strategies for dealing with national security and for dealing with veterans affairs. It's been very hard to extract that information where the government does collect it and keeps it hidden, and it's been very hard to get them to take responsibility to collect it in the first place in some cases.
To put the best possible face on it, what could you say we did get for this investment over 10 years?
Well, I don't think there's a we here. There's some people who paid the cost and bore the burden, and there's other people who made profits on it. So I think who benefited? There's a lot of companies who made lots and lots of money over the last 10 years. The amount of waste and fraud and corruption around war spending has been monumental, and there's been some attempt to account for that and shed some light on it from a variety of sources. So I think we can say, you know, there's a few people who benefited and many, many more people who paid the bill, either physically or financially. And I think future generations will be paying the bill as well because some of these monies were borrowed.
When you think of overall costs and gains, losses, How do you reckon the fact that we have not been attacked again by Al-Qaeda? Some people think this is a sort of victory.
Well, the people who look at this closely know that the victory has been on the part of those who did a kind of policing work on the problem of violence, the threat of violence, and that these wars and occupations were not necessary to accomplish the kinds of work that was done. The preventative work in New York City, for example, with the Times Square bomber was done by a couple of vendors and some local New York City policemen. So I think a lot of the idea that we've been kept safe by these wars is mistaken. We've been kept safe by the efforts of a number of people, but war and occupation was not necessary to do that.
The numbers are so huge and staggering, Catherine Lutz. They boggle the mind, and they're hard to see in proportion. But I must say, I wonder, but a lot of people still make the citizen judgment that this can't go on. We're ruining ourselves, that we're spending ourselves to death. The caution comes from a famous letter to Adam Smith by a young guy who was worrying about the costs to England of the war against the American colonies. And Adam Smith famously responded, "Be assured, my young friend, that there is a great deal of ruin in a nation, that big nations can afford this kind of thing." What's the lasting damage to the American Republic of this kind of cost?
Well, people have pointed to a number of effects of these wars that are really damaging and ongoing. One of them, reputational. Obviously, we have not made friends and influenced people through the invasion of Iraq in particular. Through the kind of civil liberties and human rights abuses that have been legitimated or excused on the basis of national security. So I think the cost to our liberty and our reputation have been important. But I think, you know, the Dwight Eisenhower warned about this 50 years ago. It's the 50th anniversary of his farewell speech in which he talked about the problem that military spending and the emphasis on military solutions was going to potentially be ruinous to the American Republic. And I think these wars are show, you know, how that happens, how we might come as a nation to accept things like waterboarding, things like massive amounts of surveillance of the American public. And again, these kinds of really quite extravagant amounts of money being spent to relatively little effect on these wars. And so he
stick with Eisenhower for a moment. What would he have made of this war, I wonder?
Well, one of the things I think he would have said was, wow, look at the military-industrial complex and how it's morphed. It's moved from building battleships to doing surveillance systems, and it's raking in just as much or more money, really, than it ever has. And there's a sort of a carry-on imperative that people who've studied this after Eisenhower have pointed to, the idea that once the funding spigot is turned on and the corporate lobbyists help to construct national security policy, that the money will continue to flow. They'll find ever more creative ways to convince the federal government that their services are needed. And that has led to this tremendous momentum forward. There are U.S. military bases around the world in places that where it makes no sense that we would still be investing so heavily in military bases in Germany or in Italy. And how did that happen? The carry-on imperative, this notion that there are people whose careers and whose profits depend on those kinds of investments continuing year after year, even if they don't make sense. And so the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have had those powerful set of interests pushing them on and saying, you know, we need to stay the course. In addition, of course, there's this sense that to withdraw now is to admit failure or to stop before we reach some kind of a goal that's been set of some kind of military victory. And even as most people acknowledge that there is no such thing possible, only political solutions. So I think the carry-on imperative is both the profit motive on the part of those who have made billions over the last 10 years, and it's also this sort of emotional and and psychological sense that, you know, these can't have been mistakes. We can't have been making a mistake for 10 years. Therefore, onward and onward to victory.
The years have also conditioned us, I'm afraid, to believe, despite all the evidence, in military solutions.
Absolutely. I think what these wars might have done over the last 10 years, if we continue to have the kind of public conversation that's just beginning now about what went wrong, we might have a conversation about our overestimation of the utility of force. We might have a conversation in which we talk about why we believe that force works. I think there's a kind of a magical thinking in this, in which people assume that if something bad didn't happen to us, it must be because we deployed military force in the Middle East. And I think that doesn't hold up to scrutiny. There's not good evidence that any significant portion of that investment panned out as assumed.
You've generated a huge amount of interest in these numbers, in this story. Do you have a notion of where it goes from here at the start of a presidential campaign year? What is people's interest in this retrospective accounting, do you think?
Well, I think people care because of the conversation about the deficit, but I think we also need to ask ourselves not so much about, you know, where we need to cut as how this happened in the first place, that we spent money on these wars, why it was so easy to mushroom the military budget like this, what kind of political life we have at this moment of the 21st century, what kind of government do we have in which huge monumental decisions about going to war are made on a very quick impulse with very little information, and what kind of governance do we have where 10 years later it's left to the university system to put a number of people together to try and assess something that the government should have assessed 2 years out, 3 years out, 5 years out, in order to say, you know, is this the path of madness to continue this way, or is this reasonable?
Of course, we knew it, but it's still a shock to read in your report that all of this was charged to a credit card. None of it was paid for out of present-day sacrifice.
Absolutely, and that's one of the reasons it continues. Many people talk about, you know, what would have been different over the last 10 years had we had a draft, right? What would have been different had we paid an additional war taxes as we went along to put all these trillions of dollars together? Would there have been much less public complacency or acceptance of the continuing wars and occupations had more than a few people been paying the price, and had we not shoved the financial reckoning into the future? Obviously, wars overseas, the fate of the people of Iraq and Afghanistan have been relatively invisible to us here, so protected from and far from the battlefield. But I think if we had more exposure to that via the media, had really shown us what that looks like, we also might have had less, put more pressure on our government to bring an end to it.
Look ahead to the political year. Some people surely are going to say we had to defend ourselves and we've been safe for 10 years. It was worth it. Other people will be critical in all manner of detail. Although nobody's really messing with your overall numbers, I notice. How would you like it to be used, this information, in the political reconsiderations of a presidential campaign?
Well, I'd like attention to be drawn to that question of who paid for the war, right? Who was injured? Who died? Who paid the bill or will pay the bill? So I think the people who say it was worth it are often not the people who paid the full price. They're not the people who have to look forward to this question of long-term unemployment, higher gas prices, you know, struggling to keep a household running in the economic environment created by the wars. So, it was worth it for a few people, quite profitable for a few people. So I would like the conversation to be in part about, you know, war profiteering and about you know, paying attention to the suffering, looking a little more closely at that wounded veteran's family, where the wife left the paid labor force in order to take care of him for the rest of his life, and the multiple medications he's on. I'd like people to know that number, 7.8 million people who have been, again, lost their homes, lost their communities in Iraq and Afghanistan. That shouldn't be acceptable to us, to leave things like that and without noticing.
I worry about the repetition compulsion syndrome, to keep doing these things without learning the lessons or the costs.
Absolutely. I mean, there isn't much space in our political culture for reflection, particularly when what we're trying to think about is whether mistakes were made, what kind of mistakes were made, and who's responsible. You know, many people think these wars are winding down, right? Certainly this idea that we're out of Iraq, right? There were no deaths last month of U.S. service members. But we still have 45,000 troops there. We still have massive amounts of money that go in every year to maintaining those troops and that activity in Iraq. And there's been a pullback to this place we were at just a year ago in Afghanistan, or you know, just a short while ago. And so we continue to invest year after year in these wars. And so I think we have to keep our eye on the fact that we're not talking history here. We're talking about the next number of years of potential continued military basing and advising in Iraq, continued long-term presence in and war-making in Afghanistan, and the numbers of people who will continue to die, the number of dollars that will continue to be spent over these next number of years. There's a real sort of desire, I think, on the part of many people to just close the door and move forward. President Obama talked about turning the page on Iraq. That's really unacceptable, to turn the page on a story that we don't even know. We don't even know the parameters of it, right? We don't know what story we wrote.
Right.
How can we turn the page on it?
Andrew Bacevich's last book refreshed for me the memory of J. William Fulbright's hearings in the Foreign Relations Committee, exhaustive inquiry on Vietnam, including extraordinary testimony by the military men themselves, the leaders of the Marine Corps and other branches, an exhaustive reflection out there in public. It was where John Kerry emerged in the world, talking about his own experience in Vietnam. We haven't had anything like that. I keep wondering, maybe it's John Kerry's job. He's now chairman of that committee. But to reflect.
Absolutely. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we had a public discussion, accounting, and holding to account, right? I mean, there's massive amounts of death and dislocation and bankrupting that has gone on over the last 10 years. This didn't just happen. People made decisions, and they made decisions to continue doing it. And I think we need to sort of ask that all be brought to the light of day. And it's in part in service to a kind of a justice, the justice of understanding, you know, what happened. Mm-hmm. But it's partly in service to the future, to, you know, will we just do this again? Will we be asked to go to war in yet another place next year, without anyone having to say, you know, this is what it will cost you. This is what it will cost the people of that country.
Here's a question I think most people don't know. I surely don't. What do we owe Iraq? Do we owe them for a broken country?
One of the things, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of effort put in, a lot of effort put into talking points from the White House, from the Pentagon, staying on message about what the goals of these wars were. And one of the things that happened was, of course, the American public was told we were going to liberate the people of Iraq and Afghanistan from tyrants. We're going to liberate the women. And then nobody really followed up with the question of, well, did that happen? Was that really achieved? And but it sells a war in the beginning to make these sort of claims. That the war has humanitarian goals, and I think one of the things that 10 years out we need to ask is, you know, what about those claims? how do they hold up? Mm. And of course, in the case of democracy, they don't hold up very well. Afghanistan's and both Afghanistan and Iraq are counted now as the most corrupt governments in their region. Neither is a true democracy in any sense. Afghanistan's down at the very bottom of the list of the world's countries in terms of political freedoms.
Catherine Nuts, thank you for the work that you and a number of distinguished scholars put into this work, and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.